6:16, Seattle's Morning News. The violent expulsion of Chinese people from the West Coast cities in the 1880s, including Seattle and Tacoma, is a pretty dark chapter in Northwest history. Our resident historian Felix Bunnell has traced anti-Chinese discrimination back even further to a law passed by the Washington Territorial Legislature back in 1864. Felix is brought to us by Lake Washington Windows and Doors. Good morning, Felix.
Morning, Dave. Yeah, in an old thesis published back in the 1920s, I stumbled across, while doing some other research, a scholar mentioned a law that created the Chinese police tax. So one of the reasons that Spokane County ceased to exist for several years back in the 1860s. It's a little complicated, but it might have been a gambit to collect more of this tax by trying to administratively fold Spokane into Stevens County. There were hundreds of Chinese working in the mining industry there. Anyway, it was that county research that led to this, me sort of learning about this thing for the first time. Now, stepping back a bit, the history of Chinese people in the Western United States is not something we hear a lot about. You know, the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882, a federal law, ended Chinese immigration to this country for about 60 years, and those violent expulsions in the 1880s tended to reduce the presence of that population. For some perspective, I spoke with a Seattle man named Doug Chin. Along with his twin brother Art, he's authored a number of books about Chinese history in Washington.
I was born in Seattle a long time ago, 1942. Went to school here in Seattle and never read anything about Chinese. I only learned about anti-Chinese stuff when my brother started doing research on it when he was a student at the University of Washington. I read one of his term papers. That's how I found out about the Chinese experience in Washington.
Yeah, so it was a little remote. And what Doug Chin found out is that the first Chinese people were in Washington Territory by the 1850s. And while those anti-Chinese riots took place decades later, there was resentment and prejudice right away. And he and his brother even mentioned the Chinese police tax on the first page of their first book.
They see the Chinese as unfair labor competition, tools of the capitalists, as well as other cultural factors. You know, they couldn't assimilate, you know, and they're anti-religion, and they were filthy. Their intelligence was below the whites and so forth. So there was cultural, ethnic, as well as economic factors that people had against the Chinese.
Yeah, and Chinese people had come to California before they came to Washington Territory, and this is in the 1840s. And so it was California that passed a law in April 1862 with this title, An Act to Protect Free White Labor Against Competition with Chinese Coolie Labor and to Discourage the Immigration of the Chinese into the State of California. Very clear, what you see is what you get. No hiding the intent there in the title. Now, the California law required all Chinese men and women to pay $7.50 a quarter as what they call the Chinese police tax. That's $30 annually, or the equivalent of about $500 today. I mean, that's real money. In that same year, 1862, Oregon imposed a $5 annual tax on blacks, Chinese, mulattoes, and Hawaiians. So then in 1864, Washington's territorial legislature passed a law with almost exactly the same title as California's. The whole law is almost a verbatim copy, though there are some differences. Now, for instance, in Washington Territory, the tax was $6 a quarter. It's a little less than California. I did find evidence of it being enforced in King County in 1866, with those who didn't pay being forced to help build a road. Now, in each county, the tax was collected by the sheriff, and the individual officer got to keep 25% of whatever he collected.
What?
Which, you know, it's an inducement or incentive, right?
But
it seems ripe for corruption, but there was paperwork involved. I don't know if any of those actual receipts surviving. I would love to track those down. Now, the remainder of the 75% was split halfway between each county and the territory. There were tough economic times during the Civil War here because government spending really dropped off, and this was sort of a gambit to raise money. Now, here's the real oddity. The law specifically gave Whatcom County a much higher rate of $10 per quarter. That's roughly $160 in 2021. Now, why would Whatcom get to charge more, almost double, than other counties? In 1864, Bellingham, as we know it, didn't yet exist in Whatcom County. Jeff Jewell at the Whatcom Museum says there were two main communities there.
They had Whatcom and Seaholme as kind of these rival two dusty towns that, or rainy towns, depending on what time of the year you wanted to look at them. You know, each with, you know, maybe 750 to 1,000 inhabitants and serving almost strictly a San Francisco market. So everything was shipped out, coal and lumber.
So there's a pretty strong economic connection between Whatcom County and San Francisco, maybe a cultural and political connection too. Now, I got a lot of help with this story from the law library at Seattle University and a retired law librarian named Kelly Kunch. They shared with me evidence they found of British Columbia essentially mimicking what California was doing. You know, they would see what California did to discriminate against the Chinese and mimic it in British Columbia. So it's not a great leap to speculate that Washington Territory was doing the same and passing its own Chinese police tax, even down to copying the language. But that higher rate in Whatcom County is still something of a mystery. At Western Washington University in Bellingham, Josh Ceretti is an associate professor of history. The higher tax was news to him, and he theorized that it's related to Whatcom's proximity to the border.
There were a number of people who would come to the States from China at that time, were transiting through southern BC. And so they would come, you know, by often from Hong Kong to Vancouver, and then from Vancouver, they might cross down by land because there were often lots of opportunities due to like periodic labor shortages down here in the extraction industry.
Yeah, so there wasn't a federal immigration policy, so maybe this was Whatcom County taking it. I don't know how they were able to get that put into the bill to be able to collect so much more tax. Now, oddly enough, California's Chinese police tax didn't last very long. It was struck down as discriminatory by the California Supreme Court same year it became a law. And in Washington Territory, it was repealed in 1869, and it warmed my heart to read the name of the law that repealed it. It was an act to repeal all police tax laws discriminating against Chinese, Mongolians, and Kanakas, or Hawaiians. So in 1869, lawmakers here were calling it what it was, discriminating. There's something encouraging about that.
Yeah.
That still, you know, it's part of the history, and Doug Chin says that knowing this kind of history is where belonging comes from.
I think it's important to know the legacy of the Chinese American experience in Washington State, because if you're Chinese, you want to feel that you contributed or you belong here in Washington, that your race, the Chinese, played an important role in developing Washington State. Otherwise, you don't feel part of it. You're at best marginalized. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So it's,
what a story.
There's so much more. I'd love to figure out the actual people involved in making that law happen and making it go away. And meanwhile, the Chinese Memorial Project will be dedicating a monument next year down on Alaska Way between Washington and South Maine to those 1885, 1886 expulsions. So it's, you got to keep this history transparent to keep learning from it. That's what I believe.
Historian Felix Bonneau, all of his features at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. 51 military families at JBLM have now filed a lawsuit over housing conditions at the base. This goes back to 2019 when toxic mold was discovered in some of the base housing units run by Lincoln Military Housing. At the time, we talked with Melissa Godoy. She and her family have been living in base housing for 10 years before discovering this. She is not a complainer, but her family started getting sick. And Kelsey White, who is also on the line with us now, is in similar circumstances. But Melissa, bring us back to 2019 and tell us how this all started.
Yeah, we started to get chronic infections like lung infections, sinus infections, ear infections, skin rashes. It was month after month of constant antibiotics, and the doctors had no idea what was wrong with us. And pretty soon they stopped treating us because we've cycled through every kind of antibiotic there is, and the infections weren't going away. It was a nightmare.
You eventually discovered that there was a mold problem in your housing unit. You opened up the walls, you found moisture inside and this toxic mold inside the walls, and you finally moved out of base housing. Now, first of all, how's your family's health? I mean, once you got out, did it improve?
We're still having some issues like asthma and stuff that we're being monitored for. But as far as like the immediate effects, like all the nausea and stuff and all the infections, those have gone away.
Okay. And Kelsey, you've also moved off the base, right? What happened to you?
Yes, sir. So when my first son was born, we first moved into the housing, his kidney stopped growing in the womb. And later on after we brought him home from the hospital, his kidney then began to die. And by 6 months old, he was in kidney failure.
Wow.
Around that time, I found out I was pregnant with my second son, and my whole pregnancy was in the same house. And as soon as we brought my son home from the hospital, from day one, he was having febrile seizures and would go unresponsive. And we would never know if we were going to walk into a dead infant or not, because he would seize in his sleep and stop breathing. We pulled out our dishwasher and there was mold all in our air conditioning vents, all behind the dishwasher, in the baseboards. It was everywhere. Since moving out of the house, we've lived out of the house a year and 6 months now. And my youngest son hasn't had a single seizure since moving out of the house.
Now, did doctors, were they actually able to associate the mold with what happened to your son?
Yes, sir. They were able to associate that it was the mold that was causing the seizures. Mm. And we lived in El Paso before we moved to Washington into that house. And I had a by-the-book, textbook pregnancy with my oldest son. He's the one with only one kidney, and his kidney was growing fine, and everything was perfectly normal with my pregnancy with him up until we moved into the house. And I had a girl scan 10 weeks after we moved into the house, and that is when we realized that his kidney was no longer growing.
Now, the housing is run by Lincoln Military Housing, which contracts with the military. I assume you went to the landlord, essentially, and asked them to fix this. What happened?
Yes, sir. I got told that there was no mold in my house, and I pulled out pictures showing that there was mold. I'm in nursing school, and I actually took it to one of my professors, and we did a mold test on it, and it came back positive for mold. And I even took that to them and showed them, hey, this is positive for mold. What can we do to fix this? I was willing to try to fix it, and they didn't care.
It was a legit brick wall. There was no advocacy, no representation, no resolution process, nothing we could do to help ourselves. We just either had to sit there and be sick or leave.
At that point, Melissa, you put together a Facebook group, and since then, other families have come forward. You now have 51 on this lawsuit. What are you demanding?
We can't really discuss the details of the case because now we have an active case, so we have to go by procedures. So we will find out when we go to trial, set for May of 2022.
What about, are there still people living in that housing at JBLM?
Oh, yeah. They're still putting families right back into the dilapidated houses that we evacuated from. All I can do is just keep putting my message out there with military families that there's issues with these houses. And if you need help, you can come to my group. This is kind of a taboo subject. You know, you don't really complain in the military.
I contacted my old neighbors to see if anyone had moved in. And as of October of 2020, housing told the connected neighbor that there will be nobody moving into that house that is unlivable. So as of right now, I don't know of anyone living in it, but I have kind of tried to keep an eye out to warn the next family because I don't want anybody to have to go through what my family went through.
How would you characterize the amount of evidence you have? Because the company, of course, has said, I believe they maintain that there is no problem or that they have fixed the problem.
A substantial amount of evidence,
an amazing amount. We got samples of the home. We had, you know,
I have doctors. Chest x-rays of showing the particles that look like stabbing needles from the asbestos in mine and my children's lungs. So all the proof is there.
Yep. We're ready. We're very ready.
Melissa Godoy and Kelsey White, who used to live on base at JBLM and are now part of a lawsuit against Lincoln Military Housing, which runs the housing units there. Thank you both. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The pandemic-prompted eviction moratorium and a new Just Cause eviction law have been passed, and in Seattle, many renter protections go well beyond what the state does. KyRadio's Hannah Scott reports now on landlords who are now, as had been threatened, they're exiting the business because of the ever-growing restrictions.
The threat of landlords fleeing the market has long been the boogeyman anytime new renter protections are proposed, and that's been especially true this past year. But is it really happening? Yes, at least to some degree.
I am divesting myself of my rental properties in Seattle quite systematically. I started doing that, I would say, 5 or 6 years ago. I sold two of them last year in the middle of the pandemic, which was not easy. So I'm one of those people that's kind of on my way out of the system instead of coming into it.
Carol Willison has owned several Seattle rental properties for decades.
The two houses I sold this last year, one I owned for 47 years, the other one I owned for 26 years. So I am not in the business of buying and flipping and doing any of that. These are homes that I used to live in or neighborhoods I'm familiar with where I've had family and friends in. And hard to get rid of some of the homes. I'm attached to them.
Selling wasn't part of the plan, at least not yet.
I just feel, particularly in Seattle, the last house I got in Seattle, I just felt I can't ever be a landlord in the city of Seattle again. I don't think I can be a responsible landlord. Being familiar with the neighbors and knowing the neighborhoods, I think the Seattle City Council has decided that the landlords in the city, particularly in the city, have to do all the heavy lifting to sort of alleviate all the social ills that plague Seattle right now. Homelessness, high rents, social inequities. Let's fix them all in the housing market. And let's have the landlords be responsible for taking care of all of those things.
Specifically in Seattle, she points to several laws recently passed.
And the laws have just been, I don't know how else to describe them except draconian. I feel politically I'm a very liberal voting person and thinking person, but I feel that first in time was almost impossible to live with, impossible to orchestrate, impossible to police. I don't know how they even go about doing that. The new roommate law that they passed last year is just ridiculous as far as having any control over the house whatsoever. People don't get into the landlord business because they have nothing else to do. It is a business.
And then there's the winter eviction moratorium in Seattle.
Very, very difficult. The winter eviction moratorium was like, really, so we're responsible for housing all these people. There's no reason. People just cannot answer your phone calls. They just, maybe they don't want to call you back. I have not had this experience. I've had very good relationships with all of my tenants. It's not untypical for me to have a tenant that stays in a house 5 to 10 years. I have a tenant right now who's in a house for 7 years, one that moved out that was there for 9 years. I've worked with them on the up and downs of the economy. I've worked with them during COVID. I called all my tenants, are you okay? Or, you know, but the main point I think is that I own these houses in neighborhoods that have good schools and provide housing to families. These are not, you know, one bedroom or studio apartments. These are single family detached homes where families lived.
And she fears
each one of those homes has been sold to somebody that is now living there. That house is permanently off of the rental market. That house that I owned for 47 years, it's been rented for close to 45 years. That house no longer has a family in it, in that good school district.
Her message to city leaders?
You are losing people like me who have been fair. I have been told by some of my tenants that I'm one of the best landlords they've ever had when they've lost jobs. I've rented to people who have gone through bankruptcies, couples who have lost money through a divorce, they've remarried, I've given them a second chance. You are not giving me the opportunity to rent to any of those people. You are blocking all of those people out of the system.
Obviously, Carol is making money off the sale of her property, so that's not really the issue here. But it does raise questions about the possibility of a shrinking housing supply as the city and the state tackle the homeless crisis.
The cumulative effect on housing providers and this erroneous rental regulation that's driving them to do what Carol's done, and that's to get out of the business. It's to sell their property. It's to look at alternative investments. So I think that and it's been happening for years, right? I mean, it starts with local policy, and then as that progresses into state policy and it's been for years now.
Jim Henderson is with the Rental Housing Association. Henderson says part of the issue is that there are so many rules and regulations coming all at once, landlords aren't always sure what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, I'm hearing from members, family members, friends, that they're taking their investment dollars and they're investing in Texas, Arizona. I think that one of the points that's often lost is that housing providers want to comply. Housing providers want to provide housing. What they don't want to fail. They don't want to make a mistake and then be hit with huge penalties or fines or fees. The legislature this year built in a lot of punitive penalty if the landlord did something. And I think that's concerning because we don't even right now, we don't have enough time to get the education out there to then help our housing providers become compliant. So, and I think that is another motivating factor that then drives our housing providers to make decisions to sell.
So, Hannah, how widespread is this? And do the members of the city council who passed this stuff have any reaction to it?
No, just the standard. They're very much about renter rights, and they will say that this isn't. And I think what Jim Henderson is talking about is not just about the city of Seattle. He's talking about the cumulative effect of all of the things that have been happening with the governor's eviction moratorium. The governor just signed a couple of bills yesterday that also the Just Cause eviction, which now requires landlords to give a legitimate reason. I think there's a list of 16 reasons in order to not to evict someone, and that includes not renewing their lease once it's up, right? And because what was happening was they were just giving 20-day notices and getting people out if they, for whatever reason, wanted to get them out that wasn't necessarily a legitimate business reason. So now that's down, and then there's a couple of other ones. There's a right to counsel for people going through eviction that the Rental Housing Association was concerned about. I will say he told me that a year ago they had a word from their membership of 7 owners who had sold. Mm-hmm. Now it's 109.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
So, as we've discussed before, if you sell the property, then the moratorium thing doesn't apply. The tenant can be kicked out. Is that right?
Correct. Yes. Yeah.
If you're going to, the new owner isn't bound by what the previous owner agreed to, obviously.
That is correct. Yes.
Hmm. All right. So it sounds to me that at some point they revise this, or their intent, which is to help people maintain their housing, is it's not going to work that way. It's going to have the opposite effect. I mean, they have to respond to that somehow, don't they?
They have to do something. And I'm not sure what you can do about, you know, the Carol in a situation like that when you're dealing with Seattle. For many landlords in Seattle, it's the restrictions, the cost, everything. You know, at the same time, the other thing going on here is property taxes that are just so high right now. Henderson was telling me about one owner he has in Tacoma where he generally rents to lower income people, keeps the rents down. That's why he's in the business. He likes to be able to offer affordable housing, but his property taxes went up 76%. And I've heard from other landlords where that same thing happened. And at a certain point, you just become upside down in it, right? So right. That's another big concern. So I don't know what you do in the city of Seattle.
No motivation to rent your housing if you can't even pay the property taxes with the rent. So obviously, you're going to have to sell it.
Yeah, so I don't know what the answer is. I will say that everyone I talked to was grateful, though. The city, the state, and the feds have all done a lot in the past several months to create these landlord mitigation funds that help with, you know, those who are behind on their rent and are covered under the eviction moratorium. It's where we go from here, I think, that's going to be a big discussion. And there are still those. There's still a big push on some sides for, you know, rent control. That's another discussion. That's something we could see coming down the pike in the legislature moving forward. So we're going to have to try to find a balance for the landlords.
Carreras, Hannah Scott. Hannah, thank you.
You bet.
Time for your daily dose of kindness, brought to you by Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated. It's already tough to be a woman in the military. Now add to that, you're an elite Air Force pilot and a mom. Cairo 7 TV's Simni Kim introduces us to that exact person who uses those titles to help others reach their goals.
Lieutenant Colonel Rachel Metzger remembers what it was like stepping into the cockpit for the first time.
I was really scared. I was a little intimidated, actually a lot intimidated. But I knew if I didn't do it, I would regret it.
That outlook has served her well in her life, even as she made the rare decision to become a military mom. Assigned to the 97th Airlift Squadron at JBLM, she's been an Air Force pilot for more than 23 years, the last 15 as a reservist. Her children are now 13 and 10 years old.
I searched for that checklist as a mother, because we have checklists in the Air Force and in the military and in flying. And if you follow the checklist, it keeps you out of danger. I searched for that checklist for years as a parent. The checklist that how to be the perfect patient parent and have kind, loving children. It doesn't exist.
The mission isn't easy, and she readily admits that she has a large support system that she relies on.
You just have to, every day, you have to wake up and just do your best. And if you don't have the best flight, if you are impatient with your children, give yourself some grace. It's okay. And tomorrow's another day.
Currently, her squadron is only about 10% women. Five of them are either already moms or are expecting.
I love providing them the support that I guess I didn't have, and not that it was anybody's fault, but there just wasn't any other pilot moms when I had my kids.
Forging a path forward for more military moms. Simni Kim, Cairo 7 News.
That inspiring story coming from our news partner there, Cairo 7 TV.
I think that is very powerful to hear an Air Force pilot mm-hmm. say that being a mom is just as challenging.
Yeah, I'm not an Air Force pilot, but I would tend to agree.
Yeah.
Well. Especially mothering in a pandemic. I mean, that's been a whole other level, huh?
And now it's 7:47 on loan from the Gian Ursula Show. Here is one of the stars of the show, G. Scott. The first order of business as the Congress turned to work this week for the Republican caucus was, as predicted, to strip Liz Cheney of her post as the number three most important person. I'm not really sure what her duties were in that capacity. But they were clearly trying to send a statement that it is the official policy of the Republican Party to support Donald Trump in basically everything he says. That's what I got from it.
I loved her quote that she made, Liz Cheney made today. And it said, quote, "We cannot both embrace the big lie and embrace the Constitution." And I never foresaw something happening like this inside of the Republican Party, especially when you have someone who, because one of the words that's always have been used, like you hear courage and courageous and truth telling. And in the case of Liz Cheney, whether you agree or disagree with how she believes, I just didn't foresee this. And especially after the election in November, I didn't know that Donald Trump would have such a stronghold on this party. I still don't understand why we have Michael Medved on our show every week, and I still try to get to the bottom of trying to clearly understand why this man really has such power over this party. Why so many of the leaders just almost bow down to everything he says and does. And so
he met his promise. I mean, they elected him to flip the Supreme Court, and that's what he did, and put in federal judges that would move forward the conservative ideals. And that's what he did. So they're willing to ignore everything else.
I guess that's the answer.
He did the job that they wanted him to do.
He owned the libs.
So now this morning, I have been, even before I got ready to come on you guys' show, I've been trying to look ahead and say, okay, what does this mean? What's going forward? And I guess I wonder, because I saw a deal yesterday, and we're going to talk about this on the Gian Ursula Show today, about how there's 100 or so Republicans that want to split up the party. And so I wonder, has the United States of America truly outgrown this powerful two-party structure? Is that the future of what's going to happen? I'll ask you that, Dave. What is your thoughts on that?
I think it's worked really well. And in countries that don't have this kind of structure, they have a bunch of minority parties, you end up having smaller and smaller groups. You know, mm-hmm. if you don't have one party in the majority, but you have a bunch of smaller parties, then sometimes like 10% of the members can decide who runs the government. And that's even crazier than what we have. And right. I have to think that this is, you know, he was a very special personality. His popularity is falling. I think it's down to 44% of Republicans now. So it may play out as people understand that he didn't deliver that much. But see, to me, the big deal here, which people don't seem to understand, is how close we came to having a real, I don't know, I have nothing else called but a civil war if that Electoral College had not been allowed to meet and finish choosing the president. I mean, that was a true crisis. I found that to be scary. And the fact you still have people who are minimizing it, say, oh, it's no big deal, only a few people died and were injured, that's not the point. The point is that they interrupted the carrying out of the constitutional election of the new president. And the fact that there are still people actively trying to justify that by looking for fraud and bamboo fibers is, I still find it hard to believe.
Okay, so let me piggyback on what you just said. So here's where I believe, I believe that our two-party system, and I think it is very important for the Republicans to continue to be strong and the Democrats as well. I think it has worked. The problem is I think that those days, I don't know if we're going to see those days again, because like you just said, on what we saw on January 6th, I would have thought like, okay, this is it right here. Like now we're going to all come together after seeing something like this, because most of us, we just want our country back. We want good things for our country. So after seeing what we saw on January 6th, I would have thought like, okay, that's it. They're not going to, there's no way going forward that anybody's going to support that man. And to know that today, here we are with Liz Cheney being ousted, and to know that he still has a stronghold on this party, lets me know that we're in new times right now, Dave. This is a new day, and we can sit here and try to ignore it all we want to, but I would have never thought that after what we saw on January 6th, that this would be still continuing.
Well, all I can say is the economy had better come back, and come back in a big way that helps everybody, not just a few. I agree with you. We're in an existential crisis. Post Backpage, sugaring has emerged as a new threat. With a report on that, here's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
For years, the discussion around kids being trafficked for sex focused largely on Backpage.com. In 2018, the Fed seized the site and new laws were passed to help protect children from the sex trade. And he warned the shutdown of Backpage and Craigslist's decision to end its personals would just lead to similar sites popping up in Backpage's wake. That's not necessarily what happened, but there is one trend growing more popular by the day that is considered a big threat to kids. Sugaring.
Sugaring is a concept where you are essentially signing up for some sort of relationship or construct where you have a sugar baby and a sugar daddy, and the sugar daddy is the one with the resources and the power and the privilege, and they give things of value, which could be a trip or a dinner or cash or clothing or jewelry, whatever it is, to the sugar baby in exchange for something.
King County Senior Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Ben Gowan says many times that's just companionship, talking, hanging out, things like that.
The problem, though, is when companionship and that sort of boundary gets extended and pushed, and then you have expectations of sex that can lead to boundaries being pushed even more, and mutuality is lost, and there's something that's non-consensual.
And that's not the only concern.
There's a lot of survivors who I work with who have somehow been affected or involved with sugaring. And really, it's a new frontier of exploitation. It's marketed in a way where you're trying to sanitize the harms of exploitation or prostitution, and it's packaged in a way where folks think they're avoiding legal liability, when in fact, this is still exploitation. It's just got a creative marketing lingo to it.
Gowan says it's definitely caught on in recent years.
We've certainly seen not only an increase in cases, but an increase in the sugaring narrative online. I mean, if you Google it, you'll find mainstream journalists and publications talking about sugaring and not really delving into the true dangers and consequences that this construct can create.
While many so-called sugar babies are college-aged, many others are high schoolers, not 18.
And really, it can create a very toxic construct. And so minors are looking at this as a way to get a cell phone or a vape pen or a trip to the mall with a credit card. And so they're Googling it, they're seeing it being glamorized. Maybe some of their friends are doing it, and so they're giving it a try.
Here's what he means.
And so what does he mean exactly, Hannah?
He means, as far as sugaring goes, there's the websites. There are a lot of these websites. I did a lot of research for the story. They're really everywhere, and they're not really as blatant as kind of some of the ads that you saw with Backpage, right? Where it's, you know, this person seeking this type of thing, and it's a lot of college-aged girls started to do this kind of thing to kind of get more lavish gifts and things like that. It was seen, or even pay for school. Some of the conversations that go back and forth online are about getting help with your student debt, right? And it doesn't necessarily say that there's going to be a sexual relationship, but the belief is, at least on the part of law enforcement, and again, with some of the former sugar babies that I talked to, that's kind of a given that's what ends up happening.
Okay, but so you've talked to these young women, and what was it that possesses someone to take any offer from a completely unknown person like that?
It's, you would be so surprised. I'll tell you the truth. I brought this up to a friend of mine who, when I started working on this story, and she told me that, I think it was 10 years ago, she was in high school. She said that she had a friend who was doing this very thing, that she was very familiar with sugaring and had heard all about it because mm-hmm. girls in her high school did it. Wasn't around when I was in high school. And I did talk to a former sugar baby. We're going to have her on tomorrow, so I'll be able to delve into that more with you, but it runs the gamut. There are some people who are, it's kind of your typical, maybe they're in a homeless situation and they need that kind of taken care of. But also, if you think this isn't your kid, this absolutely could be anyone's kid. That's what the prosecutors told me and the former sugar baby, that, you know, it could be, it's girls who just have a regular life, who want some nicer things. And there's not a lot of jobs available for people that are 16 years old and 17 years old to get the kind of nice things they want. So they see this as, a good path, because sex is desensitized for many in the current, younger generation.
Yeah. All right. So how do they approach, how are the investigations approaching this? And is this something that this is homegrown, this sugaring stuff, or is it done by overseas syndicates? I mean, how does it work?
I think there's both, but definitely homegrown. The reason that this story actually came to me was because our King County prosecutor partnered with a nonprofit called Stolen Youth that fights against sex trafficking for underage girls, sex trafficking altogether, and then a company that's here in Seattle called DNA. And what they did was create an algorithm to help combat sugaring. What it does is recognizes phrases or propositions on social media to try to interrupt the process before you even get really in the criminal justice system. Their tool categorizes the language in four different areas. They look for potential victims, exploiters, and then just kind of general media. And then the bot recognizes the language on whatever platform, that could be Twitter or whatever, social media, and then sends a message automatically to that person who posted the message. So, for instance, one example is the message would say, "Did you know that patronizing a person for sexual conduct is a crime in the state of Washington? Know the possible legal repercussions of the crime you're about to commit." And what they want, and I asked, I go, why are you going to go out of your way to try to help these sugar daddies before they do anything? Why would you want to help them and keep them out of jail? Because they don't want this to happen, right? They don't want this to happen. And a lot of times he told me that they don't always know that it's illegal, or they don't always know that it's a minor.
They don't always know that it's illegal to take somebody else's daughter and exploit her for money?
Well, in some cases, they believe that the person is an adult. So a couple of things I want to hit is that the prosecutor wanted to stress, no matter what, adult or minor, this is an illegal activity in the state of Washington, and you will be charged. And then if it's a minor, he says he's heard from people who say, well, I didn't know. They said that they were 18, which is easy to do when you sign up for these sites. Yeah. And look, you need to do your due diligence unless you see a government ID card. But again, you're still going to get in trouble because it's illegal to trade anything of value for sex in the state of Washington.
Okay, these sites, what you're talking about, they are run by what? Individuals, big money-making companies? Don't you have to put in jail the people who host these sites as well?
No, it's not. See, because there's a few different sites. As a matter of fact, I did a little Googling last night, and I found even some local ones that were fairly, R-rated, I guess I would say.
Yeah.
Those, I'm not sure why those are allowed to be up. But there's one, I think it's called Seeking Arrangements, which seems to be one of the more popular ones. I think one of our U.S. congressmen currently under investigation is linked to that investigation is linked to that site. But it doesn't do what Backpage does, right? It's not blatant. It doesn't spell out that there's anything of value necessarily being traded. And it's to some degree, just like going out on a dinner date, right? So I go out on a dinner date with you. You pay for my dinner. Maybe that's all there is to it. But what do I give you for that? So it's not written out directly in the website or the communication all the time. And that's why you don't see the kind of pushback that you did with Backpage.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. More on this tomorrow. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
You can ring my bell. Rachel Bell.
8:48 on Seattle's Morning News. It's probably more than a year since you've been to a concert or a show. But there are some kids who've never been able to at least fully enjoy a live concert or show because they have sensory issues. But that is changing. Here's Rachel Bell.
What happens when a Grammy Award-winning children's performer falls in love with a music therapist jazz vocalist?
Well, there's nothing to do but sit down and sing.
They form a band. Dan and Claudia Zanes are performing a virtual show through Seattle Theater Group later this month. But something on the press release caught my eye. Dan and Claudia only do sensory-friendly shows. These are performances designed to be accessible and enjoyable for people with neurodiversity, like autism, or for people with disabilities.
So working with ushers and the presenters in terms of, hey, it's okay if kids get up and they want to jump and they want to move about. Let people be who they are in the music, and we're okay with that. We have this culture in society where we sit in our seats and we clap at the end of songs and we sit there for long periods of time. And the reality is most people can't. I can't do that oftentimes.
A sensory-friendly show might have dimmer lights and quieter sound. There would be a designated area in the lobby where people can go take a quiet break or do provided activities.
We have therapists on every single floor of our venue and provide our audience members with fidgets and earplugs and noise-canceling headphones. It's modified to make anyone that comes into the performance feel comfortable. They feel like they belong.
That's Marisol Sanchez Best, Director of Education and Community Engagement for STG. The Paramount did its first sensory-friendly show in 2019 with Disney's The Lion King, and they've since done Charlie Brown's Christmas and Frozen. Marisol says every show sells out.
Some of the feedback that we've gotten is like, I can go to the theater, I just can't bring my son or my daughter or my niece or my cousin, or somebody has to stay home to take care of them because they can't be there during the show. We get groups of 10, 20, because it's the cousins and the uncles and the grandparents supporting, because it's the first time that they're able to go out together and enjoy a performance as a family.
STG interviewed parents of neurodivergent and disabled children at the Lion King show.
He loves watching the theater. He loves musicals, but it's too much for him without the lights and the music and everything. Usually I have to see a show first and then bring him along. So this is remarkable. This is an amazing thing.
I have a 17 and a 4-year-old who both have autism, and we haven't been able to see a show in 17 years because it's so hard. Thank you for turning the bar into a sensory center. Like, who does that? You guys get it. For letting him wear his headphones without any judgment, and for all the parents who are here who get it, and they're not judging us for being loud.
It means we can come and be excited about coming instead of coming with dread.
For some neurodivergent people, knowing what to expect at a show is very helpful. For their upcoming Seattle performance, Dan and Claudia made a video to introduce kids to their instruments before the show.
Great thing about the guitar is you can get a few different sounds out of it just by flicking a switch. There's one sound.
And if you can listen really
there's two different pitches that is happening rhythmically as well. The higher frequency.
Dan has made his living touring with bands since the 1980s.
This music will help you get a platform. And when you have a platform, then you try and do something good in the world. You know, you don't just sing about cupcakes and putting on a pair of short pants. You also use whatever popularity you might have to advance positive ideas.
The STG Dan and Claudia streaming show is free. Go to mynorthwest.com/Rachel Bell to find a link to tickets and to learn more about sensory-friendly performances. Rock by my Sarah Jean.
Rachel Bell, that was a great idea. There are some shows that I find overwhelming from a sensory perspective as well, even though I don't have any of these. I don't think I'm on the spectrum. But I can see how someone who isn't used to the kinds of special effects you have in the average Broadway show today, the volume of the music, would find this to be a completely terrifying experience unless they were had this kind of preparation.
I've seen movie theaters do it too, and I think becoming a parent too, and especially having a brother-in-law who is on the spectrum and severely so, you start to realize how tough life is for those parents with the judging looks, like you can't control your child, right? Like every child is typical and should be expected to fall in line. And the shame you must carry and the embarrassment, even though you love your child, with people looking at you, I just wish we could all just consider that person is dealing with a special needs child. You know, it's sort of like when you want to really get mad at somebody on the road, just assume they're on their way to a family member in the hospital and that's why they're driving aggressively.
Like, I know, you've told me that before. I think that's a great mind game to go through. I'm curious, when somebody, like on a plane, this will happen too, right? Yeah. You can see there's some passengers who just can't abide children. Have they never been around children or ever tried to raise them? I mean, most parents who bring kids on the plane aren't doing it because they necessarily want to. And they, I mean, I think most parents also try to prep the kid for the flight, but I don't know. I've never, having raised a couple of daughters, if somebody's acting up on the plane, unless, of course, they're kicking my seat from behind, I just assume the parents are doing the best they can. I'm not going to make it worse for them.
Yeah, if we all could be a little bit more compassionate like that, Dave, but unfortunately, it's not the norm. So I'll just keep beating that drum to just have compassion for parents. It's hard.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.